of a six-stage plan that Lauren Sani gave us. And I'm going to quickly run over these last few stages and not get so deeply involved in them as I did yesterday. And then we'll launch into our discussion on the passages of Scripture that were suggested. Now, the last day on the how-to business, I would like questions from you handed in to the conference office on what you would like to know how to. Turn them in and just mark them Leroy's class or area ministry class and tell me what you would like to know how to. This will give me some guidance. I have some ideas. I have more ideas now than I can use, really. But I'm not sure they're the real need, you see. I'm not sure they're the good... Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Welcome. Steve New. Been living in Chuck's home out in Pasadena. Arrived last night, I guess. Welcome. Glad you're here. I thought I would touch briefly on how to build morale and team spirit, the thing that Downing is covering in three sessions, that I would cover that, just some principles quickly on that. I thought I would also cover how to train men beyond the basics quickly. How to and how not to use the nav home in ministry, and your home in the ministry, and your apartment and all the rest. I thought that I would cover essential weekly meetings for your key men and how to conduct them, and key gals. I thought I would cover how to plan and promote and conduct a weekend conference or a one-day conference or an area rally or a key man's retreat or a 10-week seminar. I thought I would cover how to and how not to use NAV materials with individuals, small groups, and large groups. Thought we might get into some of the how-to of back review of Scripture memory, but I don't think we're going to get in on that. But we might if you.
How long is this conference?
Now those were just things that came to my mind. But if I would like to know from you what you would like to know how-to, so that we. Have some good, clear guidance for this last session, which will be on Monday. Now, today we're up to stage three. Stage one was thrust, stage two was consolidation. Now, stage three is obvious. Stage three is thrust again. Repeat stage one. Go back to plan A. Make another thrust. You have a thrust. Then you have a little consolidation and regrouping of the troops and solidifying and all that. And this stage three, then, is going to be another thrust. And this time, of course, it'll be with greater impact than stage one was, because now you've got more people around, more trained personnel. And you can make a broader thrust and a deeper thrust. And stage four is also obvious. Stage four is repeat stage two. Consolidate again. And this consolidation takes the form of one-day retreats or half-day seminars or weekend conferences, one-day conferences, getting people to the Glen for conferences. I don't know why, but when I was in an area, it suddenly occurred to me, as I observed the thing, that people were more with it when they met some other NAV leadership other than just the area rep. When they met Lauren Sani, when they met Jim Downing, and when they met various ones that would come through for these weekend conferences, when Warren Myers would come to speak, or Chuck Farah, or we had Waldron Scott, or we had Hugh Harris, and so on. And when they would meet these men and get involved with them, when Addie would come through and meet with the gals and so on, they seemed to be a little more with it. Somehow this did something. Now, they didn't say anything differently than you would say. or that I would say, it's just somebody else saying it. So this matter of consolidation, if you can import somebody, if you're in Pasadena, why import John Watts to let him say it for half a day? Or if you're on the East Coast, why import Jim White or Bob Stevens or somebody? Just a new voice often helps. And I'm not sure why that is. I've heard pastors say that they preach the gospel and they preach it and they preach it, and then Billy Graham comes to town and clears his throat and 85 people come forward. You know? How do you account for that? Well, he didn't know. Nobody knows that. But then consolidate. Now, stage 5 is to harvest potential leadership in the area for the area. By the time you're involved in this second consolidation, you pretty well know who your leadership will be and who the ones are that are really making real progress and who are beginning to get these things really on their hearts. And these people you bring in closer. Much closer. Yes. You repeat you harvest potential leadership in the area for the area. This is where I think the idea of the grouping together of the band comes. You don't want to do that too quickly, you know. Because the man that shows the initial enthusiasm might not be the one that sticks with it. In fact, he probably won't be. The reason for that is this. Here come the navigators to town. Navigators? What are they? And he gets all excited and all enthused and all this business and that. And then something else comes to town. Or somebody else does something, you see. And he's sort of the fellow that's always involved in hearing some new thing. All enthusiastic about it first, and then kind of. So, when Paul says, "Lay hands on no man suddenly, neither be thou partakers of another man's sins," Philip says, "Don't be in a hurry to ordain a man, or you may be making yourself responsible for his sins." What is that? 1 Timothy 5:22. Is that what that is? Well, I don't know which is right: either partaker of his sins or responsible for his sins. But I don't want to be either. But the idea is, don't be in a hurry to get people into positions of leadership. Let time have its work in his heart. And you bring them in closer. And at this point, it seems to me, as I reflect on how the Lord has led in my life and the way this has all seemed to work out, this is about the time when you begin to form your key man Bible studies or key gal studies. This is not for the masses. This would be for 3 or 4 or 5 people. And your key people's prayer meetings. And this might be the time when someone would move into your home. Ed, is George living in your home now?
Yes.
How long was he around before you invited him in?
About a year.
Mm-hmm. You saw his production, you saw what he was doing, saw his heart was in the game. In our eagerness to get involved in these things, you know, and we can make mistakes here. And just kind of watch that. And these guys in the home does a great deal to knit hearts, and they learn from each other. And matter of co-laboring in evangelism, that is very good. But all of this is involved in harvesting potential leadership in the area for the area. Then stage 6. And stage 6 is a harvest of leadership from the area. And this I saw as probably the key, to creating an atmosphere in which potential leadership could become effective. You see, your work on your campus, or your work in your apartments, or your work through your home, or wherever you are, on the base, there can be an atmosphere attached to that that either squelches leadership or produces it. You ever plant tomatoes? Spring, you go out and you plant your tomatoes. You dig a hole and you fill it with water and you put a corn cob down there. By the way, if you ever plant tomatoes, put a corn cob down. It's real good. Then stick your tomato plant in and heap it all up and mound it up good, and then you got it in the ground. Then the sun comes out. So you get a newspaper up over it and put some clods around to protect it from the sun, or the wind starts to blow. Or we hear of a frost coming that night. And so you put a cap on these things. And you keep doing that for a while. But pretty soon you got to take the cap off, otherwise you get a stunted plant and then doesn't go anywhere. I'm working in the Midwest. Bob Stevens is my right-hand man. He's the guy I look to. He's counsel. We pray together the most. He's the one that's the key man in the area, the right-hand man. It occurred to me that if I'm going to develop another Bob Stevens in his same position, I got to get rid of Bob Stevens. So I skim him off the top, send him to the Glen, and then Rush Johnson emerges and kind of takes that slot. Well, it occurs to me, I got to get rid of Rush Johnson. If Jerry Marshall is going to come up, so I get rid of Rush Johnson and ship him off the Glen, and then Jerry Marshall emerges. Then I got to get rid of Jerry Marshall, you see? Now here's where area people, and here's where you all can make a tragic mistake in thinking that you want to keep around your best man all the time. That's a mistake. Because that squelches the producing of real top leadership. But you hear people say, and area reps fall in this trap, I think, boy, I can't get rid of him. Boy, if he leaves, you know, he's got to leave. Because if he doesn't leave, who else is coming up to take a real position of leadership? So this is one of the keys to me in creating an atmosphere in which real potential leadership becomes effective. The harvesting of leadership from the area. And these top men are skimmed off and they go to the Glen, or they go to another area and repeat the process, starting with stage one. If you don't skim off the top men and give the rest growing room, why, you've squelched the production of leadership. Well, so much for stage 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Any questions on all this business? Now, before we go into discussion of the chapters that we were to look over. Okay?
What's your idea of supplements? Is this a new trend?
No, sub-homes have been around for, well, DOS was the guy that invented the phrase, or the idea. And it seems to me right now that sub-homes are not nearly as popular as they were 4 or 5 years ago. The trend seems to be away from this idea rather than into it. Now, this is not to say that we don't have key contacts scattered around that are doing the job, but sub-home, to me, has the idea somehow of sort of a second fiddle operation, kind of a second-class citizen, sub-citizen. And I, in my thinking, the people that are really doing the NAV work, it's not the area rep, but the people involved with him in the area. And the idea of a sub-home kind of puts a second-class citizen idea stamped to him. And in my mind, the people that are actually doing the NAV work in the U.S. are guys like Ed over here in New York City. And guys like Bud View in Des Moines. And Bob Potter and Gene Warren, Oklahoma City. And Joe Coggeshall. And I go right around the line here. These are the people that we really count on. Probably more than these people realize. I was telling someone last night, I bet there isn't a week goes by, but what your name, Ed, is mentioned here on the Glen. either in prayer or in discussion of the area of work or something. And so I would rather have it with a less official sounding thing, nav sub home, but upgrade the thing to the point where they are actual co-laborers in the thing. But to me, if the NAVs are ever gonna see this vision accomplished that we have on our hearts, it's not going to be through the developing a professional NAV staff. It's going to be more like guerrilla warfare, where you have a few well-trained, highly skilled professionals, quote-unquote, and these people can develop a great army of people that are actually doing the warfare. So that Jack Mayhall in Chicago is one man. But through Jack, we hope to see dozens of these key contacts raised up, laymen living where they are that are actually doing the job. To me, that is the long-range, broad view of area NAV work. A few hardcore, thoroughly brainwashed navigators scattered around, and then he is developing and working through dozens and hundreds of others. It also seems to me that this sub-home business limits the thing. Because you see, the thing that I'm talking about here, an area could have a dozen or 15 or 20 of these things. But a sub-home, it's just a little, there's something official about it. And then NAVs have always been kind of scared to let too much official stuff get going, and so we might squelch the whole idea. So I really lean toward a less official, but upgrade the work that's done by the people out around. I don't know whether that makes, well, I've communicated that or not, but that's how I feel about it. Any other questions?
Nero, would you define what you consider a sub-home net? What the original definition of it was?
Yes, now we had one in, we have one in Fort Worth. The navigators own the furniture. I think navigator money is run through for the rent or something. And so on. Well, see, we can't have many of those deals. But your home, you own your furniture. You have on your heart, we have on ours. We can have dozens of those, you see. Just a less official, but upgraded.
Jim Downing did some initiative that was kind of new. Matter of 1 year term. What is that? One year term responsibility?
No, one assignment. The idea is that there are well, really dozens of people around the NAVs who probably won't have the NAVs as their long range lifetime. It won't be one of this hardcore thing that we talk about here. But we feel and they feel that maybe a one-term assignment, say running a home for servicemen work, say in Germany. He's thinking primarily in terms of overseas servicemen's work. And this assignment would give a couple or a single man overseas experience. It would broaden their outlook and their view because of the overseas experience, and all, it would make them better trained, better equipped. But it wouldn't be with a view of a lifetime service, but kind of a short range, maybe a 3-year hitch, and then back to whatever the Lord has for them, but with this experience in their background. This is what Jim is thinking of for couples and single guys. And the advantage, of course, is that the training it gives the guy. He may not be one of those that God has chosen as a long-range co-laborership with the NAVs, but this experience sure won't hurt him. It'll help him And it'll help us. We'll mutually benefit from the thing, and the Lord's work will be advanced. And then wherever God has him, he'll be a better man for it. But that's the one-term assignment idea. I don't know whether it's going to work or not work. See, isn't that what these the ideas, you know, these things we're just shooting at? Let's go to, let's take 1 Samuel 17. What did you get in 1 Samuel 17 that taught you about the objective, about how to fulfill the objective, about handling opposition in the battle, about the battle itself, and so on? Russ, what did you see in this?
Not much.
How much?
I didn't get to read it.
Ah, confession is good for the soul. Okay, let's have a little go around. Who didn't get to read it? So I won't call on... Okay, good. Stan, you read it through. What what'd you see in there that...
Yeah, for the objective, I took overall, actually verse 47, that all his enemies shall know that the Lord saveth not the sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's and he'll give you into our hands. And David mentioned in another verse that Goliath was defying the God of Israel in the, that's in verse 26, the armies of the living God. And this seems to be underlying the whole thing. And then breaking this down, actually, there's the objective of defeating the Philistines, which is implied in verse 2, because they were in battle with him.
Mm-hmm.
And then defeating Goliath, specifically. And that's in verse 32. As far as the way David did this, he just went out on faith, really. In verse 37, for instance, why it points this out. And I believe this is where he made his bold statement.
Yes.
Yeah.
And faith based on something that God had done for him in the past. He had actually seen God work, hadn't he? That's important. But he won this battle by faith. When did David win this battle, this particular battle? Before he threw the rock? When he threw the rock? Or after he threw the rock? Before he threw the rock. This battle was won before he ever threw that rock. Now there is a lesson. The battle was won in his mind, in his heart, before he ever got a hold of that rock. He was confident of victory. Because he knew that God was going to defeat this enemy. Therefore, when you're at Glenary this week, there are certain battles back in your area and certain victories that you can claim and win in prayer up that canyon or up on Dawson's gravesite or wherever you can go for an hour or so with the Lord and really get some victories won for God and settle some things and claim. But you're right, Stan. This battle was won by faith. Hebrews 11 again. Okay, Walt?
Another thing that he did, he used tools and equipment that he had proven.
Right. Yeah. He knew his weapons. He when he went out, he knew how to use these things. Very good. And the tools and weapons that he himself had proven.
I think that would include also he had proven himself physically he was trained and strong.
Yes. And in his mind, God had proven himself too, hadn't he? God had proven himself to him. He delivered me out of the paw of the lion, the paw of the bear. what does this meathead think he's going to do? One more paw to overcome here. Okay, first to Laura and then Carl.
I noticed that the same thing you were talking about yesterday is the way the leader is to reflect on the men. Saul was scared, so consequently his men were scared. And then they tried to scare David too. Have you seen that big man over there? Mm-hmm. And it's almost the idea that they try to justify themselves because they're scared. They want to bring everybody else down and they're scared.
Yeah. We see that in Deuteronomy 20 also, don't we? But here, now Saul, who was their tallest man? Saul. You know, he was the logical one to go out and fight this tall man. But along comes David. God has this uncomfortable habit, see, of laying his hands on the wrong man. Logically, Saul was the man to fight this fellow. Notice how easily the forces of God are frightened. The forces of God are easily frightened. When Saul and all his, verse 11, heard those words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Words, and they were afraid. Let's go to Carla.
One of the things I noticed is that David didn't assume Goliath as his enemy, but he was defying God, so it was God's enemy and God's job to take care of the enemy.
Yeah, this is a spiritual battle here, isn't it? Did you notice that? It's a spiritual battle he fought. Did you notice that David had world vision? That all the earth may know there's a God in Israel. He had the world on his mind here when he went out here. He was going to prove something to the whole world with one rock. Or when I noticed the sling and the stone, if I put down little as much, if God is in it. If God is in it, you know. Lauren?
And he was also over-prepared. I heard Goliath had four brothers, so he took four other stones.
Yeah, I've heard that same idea. Why did he take five stones? Well, Goliath had four brothers in case they might show up, you know. Does anyone know who studied Hebrew how tall he actually was in terms of feet and inches?
He's
9'3"? Tall old boy, huh?
I didn't study Hebrew. I just married.
Thank you for that admission. You had me faked out there for more advice. If you notice his Goliath's person and his armament, it's the same today. The forces of the evil one, the forces of the world are big and gaudy and costly and powerful and well-equipped and loud and proud and sure of themselves and ready to challenge anyone. This is a picture of the world. And along comes David with one rock. Winnie?
Another thing, too, they tried to put all Saul's armor on. They tried to prepare him in the
way. Yeah. Had he listened to counsel there, which was logical, he may have really goofed things up.
Two things wrong with this. I think it's interesting that he stayed within his capabilities. And so many times when we're trying to fight a battle, we go beyond our capabilities. And he knew that he was adept with the stones, but he knew that he had no training with the armor and the sword.
Very good. Stayed within his own known limits.
And then also, the other night when you were mentioning leadership and the qualities, I just noticed when you had mentioned calm and courage, that David is a perfect example of this one. Goliath is just coming toward him, he just runs up and
Calm, courage, and midst of tumult here. Right. Anything else, okay?
And we just in here that he was but a youth in his brains, and whose son I thought a young man, but even a young man.
Very good. Lauren, wasn't it Lauren the first opening night said a little one shall become a thousand? A little one. 1 Corinthians 1, the lesson that Doss gave me when I was in Pittsburgh. You know, doesn't have to be just a young one or a little one or an insignificant one. Carla?
I noticed too it said that he ran to meet the giant. when he was ready for battle, he didn't stand back away. He took off for the battle.
It seems to me that David took the initiative in this thing, didn't he? And carried the battle to the enemy. He didn't wait for the enemy to carry the battle to him.
You were saying yesterday that he prepared for opposition, and when David first comes up and asks what's going on, his brother could have very easily gotten under his skin by talking the way he did and trying to get him just to leave and forget it all. And instead of fighting with him, he just gives him an answer and goes on with his
Yes, in fact, I think that was the first battle that David had to overcome, was opposition from his brother. And oftentimes, when we're in a battle with the enemy, Satan will try to get us into a battle with our brothers, with fellow Christians. You see, had David fallen for this particular trap and had gotten involved in a big fight with his brother, he may have not ever gotten to the enemy. And you don't have to look very far today in Christendom to see some people that have fallen for this old trap. And in big battles with their brothers, you know, wars raging and headlines and newspapers and publications and tracts and books and energy and money and all this tremendous expenditure fighting with his brother. And there stands Goliath, laughing and shouting and screaming, you know, defying, and no one pays attention to Goliath. We're all out here fighting with our brother. Terrible. That's a terrific lesson, Sandy. Good lesson.
I think and overall, David was away from this battle, and he had his perspective squared away before he came near the front line. And therefore, when he was in this front line, his perspectives were not distorted.
That's an excellent observation. I think that that's probably one of the keys to this whole thing. Well, of course, the key is rests back in verse 16, back in there when you find out what David was doing. He's keeping the sheep. David was anointed king. Now, the king's job was to head up the army, the commander-in-chief of the army, and the administrative, the administrative aspects of running the government. Well, now, David had neither had a course in Business 101 or ROTC 1, you know. He had had none of these. All he had was a real deep acquaintanceship with God. While everybody else was over here fiddling around, David was keeping the sheep on the other side of the hill over here, sitting around strumming and meditating on God and writing these psalms. And his one quality that he had, that I see in chapter 16, was the fact that he knew God. And the rest of them were all involved in the Mickey Mouse. And David was over on this side hill over here, the man that knew God. So when he got into the battle, his perspective was right. God was big and great to him. Well, this 9-foot clown over here, you know, how could he compare to the one that he had just been with? And he knew that God was with him. Good lesson. If you check Daniel 1 as a cross-reference, you'll see that... let's see, where is this thing? Verse 4, all the people that were involved in this training program, they were going to teach them the learning and tongue of the Chaldeans. As says, children of Israel, verse 3, and children of the king's seed and the princes. Now, this is both children of the Lord and children of the world. Children in whom was no blemish, they were physically fit, but well favored, they were socially acceptable people. Skillful in all wisdom, cunning in knowledge, understanding science. They had horse sense, they had practical wisdom, they had education, understanding science. And such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace. Diplomatically capable people. You could put it, he'd be at home anywhere. They all had those characteristics. And yet God laid his hand on one of them. Daniel's purpose in his heart, that he would not defile himself and go against his convictions that God had given him. All of these characteristics they all have. Daniel here had one further. A deep spiritual walk with God. So with our friend David over here, he had something that the rest of them didn't have. He had an intimate knowledge of God. Anything else in this chapter you see?
It's interesting to note David's respect of what Saul wanted to do gave him his chance to carry out in verse 38. He let Saul go ahead. But I think he had it pretty well in mind what he was going to do all along. Was set in his conviction, but he also respected authority. And he let the thing work itself out so that Saul got his little say, and yet at the same time David got his way.
Yes, that's an important principle there. We think of the same thing in Daniel. Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself, so he requested of the prince, of the eunuchs. He didn't go and shake his fist, I purposed in my heart, and now you will never force me, you know. He had his convictions, but he handled it in such a way that he won the favor of the people that were over him. That's an important lesson.
This reminded me of the armor of God. This is all we need. And I can kick off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you see it says, therefore, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of His might. And then mentions certain aspects that we can do, but it's really strength in God and the power of His might. Then put on various things, but it's the strength that God gives.
David knew him and he inquired to find out about his tactics and so forth. So what to expect.
Knowledge of the enemy. Mm-hmm. That's an important one. When Howard Hendricks was here at this last conference, he gave us some talk on Nehemiah, the man who knew his enemy. That's important. Jim?
When he went out to meet Goliath, he killed him with one stone. He didn't dally around. He got the job and did it. Didn't waste any motion or any time.
He knew his objective and went at the objective. Right. Russ?
A little bit of follow-up here. He just knocked him down. He went and got the sword.
Right. Joyce?
We've probably said this a little bit in other words, but this is such a foolish idea, and you said the other night to be willing to do something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's ridiculous to think of little David doing this, that he's willing to do. Foolishly courageous.
Wasn't logical.
At all.
Jonathan, let us go into the garrison to some circuit. Maybe the Lord will work for us. Well, maybe God will work. Let's go see what happens. That's terrific, yeah.
David didn't lose his head after this thing was over with.
Only Goliath. Three rules to remember here. Direct hit, an atomic explosion. One, don't lose your head. Two, keep cool. And three, don't fly all to pieces. Okay, we're ready for Deuteronomy 20. Let's see, it's can go for a while. This thing will keep clicking away. All right, Deuteronomy 20. These are principles or laws to be observed in time of war. Now, you know the background of this chapter. Israel is not yet a kingdom. Israel is more of a kind of an armed camp than a kingdom. And they're entering into enemy country. And God thought it necessary that they should have some kind of direction in their military affairs. And so He gives them these principles to be observed now in military affairs in their time of war. And all these things, of course, happen unto them for examples, and are written for our admonition, things that we might learn from them. So in light of that, what do you think are some laws or some principles that we can observe here in the matter of spiritual warfare? Okay, Lauren?
Do some eliminating before battle, before you choose leaders here.
Okay, now on what basis do you eliminate?
They eliminate themselves. Like in verse 5, it's material goods or some other project that we're working on, which I think almost all of these, except the last one, would just eliminate a person for a while, but not necessarily completely.
The last one is verse 7?
Verse 8. Fearful.
Oh, fear.
Yeah, the fearful. I think the difference between this fearful in verse 1 and the fearful in verse 8 is that this man in verse 8 is already defeated. This other one just has fear that needs encouragement by a promise or something from God. But this other guy, seems to me, he's already defeated. He's faint-hearted and fearful.
You see, in verse 5, it talks about his possessions. Verse 6, it seems to me, is talking about his work, his job, his occupation. And verse 7, he's talking about his wife, his life partner. Now, did anyone think to cross-reference this with Luke 14? Look at Luke 14, beginning with verse 18. And they all with one consent began to make excuse. The first said unto him, I have planted a piece of ground, and must needs go and see it. I pray thee have me excused. His possession. He's got a piece of property here that he's involved with. His things here are taking up his thought and energies. Verse 19, it's his work. Another said, I have bought 5 yoke of oxen. I must go prove them. I pray thee have me excused. Here he's involved in his job. And verse 20 says, I've married a wife. And he's involved with a person that takes priority over the work, over the cause of Christ, or the person of Christ. Things can take priority. Your job can take priority. Or some person can take priority over the work of Christ, the cause of Christ, or the person of Christ. Well, that's what you see listed here in Deuteronomy 20. It's an Old Testament illustration of a New Testament principle. Now, the man that's all wrapped up in his possession, his little stack of toys, you know, here, that he's fiddling with all of his life, he's not much use in the battle. The man who's involved in a job that takes precedence over the Great Commission, well, he, of course, he's on this daisy chain assembly line, spends his lifetime assembling daisy chains, you know. And then verse 7, back in Deuteronomy 20, he says, well, you know, he said, since we last talked, I've married a wife, and I don't think that the things that we talked about fit in for her plans for my life. And so I can't come. I can't go to battle, you know. And that's kind of a permanent problem, because 1 John 1:9 doesn't cover that one. You claim 1 John 1:9 and wake up the next morning, she's still there, you know. So kind of a permanent sidetrack, unless God really does something in her life. Or in his life, you know, with the gals, of course. So that's so important. But I put down on all of those the old D-G-I-W-T-H-H principle. This is the don't get involved with the heel draggers principle. Or with the half-hearted principle. Just don't get involved with these people. There's too much to be done to get involved with the half-hearted. To get deeply involved with this kind of person, boy, it just saps your energy. Because you're always trying to drag them along, you know. Why get involved? Yes.
I got something else out of that.
Okay.
Those, I found thought that the captains, or the officers rather, spoke this thing to all the people that were going to be involved in the battle. Therefore, those that didn't return at least had been propositioned to the aspect that they were going to die, or that at least the possibility.
Mm-hmm.
So every man was prepared to die to these three areas.
That's good. The conditions for being part of this crew were carefully laid out, weren't they? Everybody knew what it meant if you joined up with this bunch. I think that's an important factor. And knowing, of course, there's the ultimate possibility of death out here. But death to these things, for sure. Very good. Sandy?
This is real good because usually in a battle, as we know it today in warfare, for instance, you just take everybody, whether they want to go or not. And this isn't what we should do in our type of warfare, as you pointed out the other night, and which is true right here. It would be better to have a few who are dedicated to the cause than have just a mob of people who don't care, because you're not going to get any work out of them and can't work with them at all.
I'm glad to see you recognize that. So the Marine Corps have operated on that premise for years, you see. Those that want to join the Marines, they take. Remember Gideon, see, first he eliminated the Army, then he eliminated the Navy, and then he had the Marine Corps left. And now I'm getting done. That hard, small corps, see, always the backbone. Oh, let's stick with the chapter here. Let's stick with it. You know, like the fellow says, it's obvious that this passage means this, you see. So, another principle, something else you saw in here. Sandy?
Well, the very, very first thing I saw right in the first verse was to be optimistic with your faith in God. I mean, these people could have just really been pessimists and thought, well, you know, what chance do we have? But instead, it says, you know, don't be afraid because of this, that, and the other thing. Have faith in God. You know that it's his battle, and then he'll win again, the same principle.
Right. That was the first principle I jotted down. Believe God and his word. Faith. That's the positive aspect of the thing. Positive faith in God. That's a principle of war. Spiritual warfare.
I mean, that's Georgia?
Mm-hmm. Go. Good verse. New Testament principle there. Very good. Jim?
Along that same line, verse 1 and 2, both say when, not if, you go to battle.
I hadn't seen that. When, huh? Not if.
Also, right there, it's if. Fear is broken down into two parts. First of all, don't be afraid to be outnumbered. And then don't faint with fear. And then it implies that this is not just a suggestion, this is a commandment. Therefore, to be afraid is a sin.
Oh, yeah, all through the scriptures, fear not, neither be thou dismayed, huh? That's a command, fear not. God has not given us a spirit of fear. And here's something that I jotted down as a matter of fear. I cross-referenced Isaiah. I think this is the one, Isaiah 8, a real good verse. I think it's Isaiah 8, 11 and 12. Let me check this. Yeah. For the Lord spake thus unto me with a strong hand, and instructed me that I should not walk in the way of this people, saying, say ye not to them a confederacy, to all them with, to whom this people shall say a confederacy. Then he says this, neither fear ye their fear, nor be afraid. It's possible to fear nothing but fear. You see, one rotten apple spreads its influence in the whole barrel. You get one person that's afraid, and that spirit kind of permeates. The guys went up to Greeley last winter to witness in a put on a fraternity meeting. And when they got there, they called and somehow discovered that the fraternity had forgotten it. And I forget who it was, But one or two of them said, well, then we shouldn't probably go over and bother them. They might get upset, you know. And one of the guys says, look, we're up here, and they're over there. Let's go get them. If we go there and show up, well, they'll take us in. It's not our fault. It's theirs. Let's, you know, plow ahead. And they did. It was one of their best times. And I don't know how many, I think two or three guys met the Lord that night or through that thing. But the Spirit began to go around, boy, maybe we shouldn't go. Maybe they, you know, and kind of a little hesitation. Of course, that's the easy way out, you know. And one of them said, ah, let's go. And away they went and did it. Neither fear the, you, see, that's one of the problems of having a fearful man on the team. Because he's always bringing up the, but what if thing. Oh, but what if, he says. But what if? And that's bad. Jeremiah 1:17 is a good thing on this matter, a good verse on this matter of fear. It brings out quite a disconcerting idea. He says, thou therefore gird up the loins and arise and speak unto them all that I command thee. And be not dismayed at their faces, lest I confound thee before them. Be not afraid of their faces, lest I confound thee before them. The Lord doesn't appreciate lack of faith and trust. You see, He's allowed to teach us a lesson through it. Anything else in here? Okay, Joyce?
Verse 9, there were obvious leaders that were put over the truth. And was it you who mentioned that yesterday too, about conferring authority and responsibility publicly?
Notice today's way of operation. Well, let's form an organization. Let's get a deal going. Okay, now who'll be president? Okay, you be president, you be vice president, you be the secretary. We form our leaders first. Then we get our crew. They got the crew, saw who among them would qualify, and out of that bunch chose some leadership. Again, you see, don't be in a hurry to ordain a man. Lay hands on no man suddenly. I learned a number of bitter lessons on this one. Remember Mike? Boy. In fact, I think that's when we all got that verse and began to dream about it, you know. Here, this big, handsome guy showed up, you know, with all the qualities and all the testimony. And, man, see, all of us, he was right in with us all at once. And then, what a lesson. Bad, bad lesson. It's amazing what God will do and permit us to go through just to teach us one little lesson. It's amazing to me. Have you ever seen, notice that about the Lord? Tremendous federal case that He develops around, you know. And all the Mickey Mouse that goes with it, and it's all over, and then we get this one lesson out of it, you know. Boy, He'll go to great lengths to teach a lesson. It's one of the interesting things about working with the Lord. Such an unpredictable person, you know. He's always, you never quite know what He's up to and what He's going to do next. Exciting life. Okay, another one. First Carla, and then Margaret.
Well, the first thing I noticed was in giving the directions, the first is from the preacher as a representative of God. And so, go to God first, and the Lord's direction was that you will approach the enemies, but you're not to fear. And then it got down to the officers telling the men about the possession.
Hmm.
But the first point of direction was from God.
Now, where is that? I don't think I see that.
Verse 2 and 3. The priest shall approach and speak.
I see. Oh, yeah, I see. That's good, isn't it? Okay, Margaret?
In connection with the chapters discussed, Paul, they hadn't even been in battle yet, and yet in verse 14, for one, and I know it's the same thing as in one way or another throughout, the Lord thy God has given thee, it had already been given to them. And then... is this where they got their plan A and B down here in verses 11 and 12, where they went in peacefully just to take the city?
Hey, I hadn't seen that.
And then down here in verse 19 and 20, I don't know if this has any connection, but I noticed in verse 20, that they cut these trees down, and yet they just didn't cut them down. They used them for something. And I just wondered if there was something that perhaps we could waste our strength and time in battle on something that wouldn't be any profit to us.
Yes, and notice there were some trees that they didn't cut. Did anyone see a principle in that? Okay, there's one other thing I had in mind on this. Joyce?
Well, it would be that the things that you could use in the battle to put in the siege. I couldn't figure out what the tree was, but anything that was an available source of power was used and not condemned.
Yes, but why did they leave certain ones standing?
It seemed to me that they're preparing for a permanent war. That they're supposed to fight until they subdue it.
Yes.
So they were prepared for the permanent.
And now that, to me, the one aspect of that I saw, this permanent idea, in the haste to get in and do this battle, they could have just sort of blatantly gone ahead and cut down anything to be used and say, well, we need it now, let's use it, and destroyed that which they could lose for a long-range operation. And I applied it now to myself. This is where I got my application out here, by the way. I said, don't destroy that which you will later need for a long-range opposition. Public favor, for instance, with the dorm leader or with the chaplain. We're anxious to get on this base and do a work for God, to see men saved. Why have a chaplain? We don't have time for that kind of Mickey Mouse. Let's get on there and preach the gospel. Might be good for the first month or two, but what about the long range? Don't destroy that in the initial haste that you'll need for a long-range opposition. And when I say destroy that, to me, the application was the public relations with the pastors and the chaplains and the dorm leaders or whatever else we have. In our haste to get a job done, let's don't destroy those things that we'll need for the long-range operation. So that was a principle that I saw in there. And you mentioned, Margaret, verse... And when the Lord thy God hath delivered it into thine hands. Again, this battle was won before they ever went out to fight it. And they knew. There were long-range follow-up plans here. But the women, the little ones, and the cattle and all that, they had it doped out what they were going to do. Now here's a point in area ministry. Look at the thing from here to here. Don't look at it from here to here, and then 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 here to here. Figure the thing out from here, backwards. This is where it's so helpful to have a guy around who will think. Some guy will come roaring and say, Lee, let's do this. Oh, if we do this, I say, okay, now wait a minute. If we do this, is this likely to happen? Well, yeah. Now, if that happens, is this likely to happen? Yeah. If that happens, will this likely happen? Yeah. And if that happens, will this likely happen? Yes. Do we want that to happen? No. Well, then let's don't do this. You see. Well, try to view the work from a long-range standpoint. And hasty thrusts and all that. That's what we talked about originally at the beginning yesterday. This prayerfully thought-through thrust. Determining a thing prayerfully before God and have His direction before we ever start. I'm not talking about dawdling here, but prayer is not dawdling, you see. Another principle? Jim?
Verses 10 through 18, especially verse 17, talks about doing a complete job, utterly destroying the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And then verse 18, the reason is so that they won't be taken in by the practices of the enemy. And they ran into this problem in going into a country and not destroying the enemy, and then pretty soon they were intermarrying with them and didn't help them from the enemy.
Yes, I jotted that down as a principle also. Make provision for you and your men to be not conformed to this world. I'm kind of old-fashioned about a lot of things. As far as the entertainment of the world and all the stuff that goes on that guys can go to and say, well, that doesn't hurt. Well, that's true. But I personally have been involved most of my time since I've been a Christian with younger Christians. And if they see Lee doing this, they're liable to do this, you see. Well, Lee does it. So I'm just, I just try to make real solid provision for my own life and lives of the guys for whom I feel a responsibility to not get conformed to this world and get involved in its practices and all the rest. But I saw that, Jim. I think that's good. Lauren?
Well, they were going to use the enemy if they could, but they couldn't. They were still going to take him. The idea of verse 11, get them to open unto thee, and then you can even use them as tributaries unto thee, and they will serve thee. And just like you mentioned about going to Indiana State, they use the enemy. They open the door for them.
Mm-hmm.
They start calling people, becoming a tributary, and we're serving.
Mm-hmm.
But if they would do it, they're still going.
Where did I hear yesterday about the wrath of God? Something that praise him. Some wild thing happened around here, and it was, could have been able to blow up, and then all of a sudden the Lord turned it, and it was a perfect way to glorify God. I can't remember the situation. But that's true. Did you notice, well, you would may not have noticed this, but in verse 3, it says, let not your hearts faint, fear not, and do not tremble. Do any of you have a marginal note on not tremble, on the word tremble?
Make haste.
And I thought of running around madly in tight circles, you know, with no real, solid, carefully thought through direction. And I put down there Isaiah 28:16 and 1 Peter 5:8. But the idea of a carefully thought through business. Believe God and His Word. Don't fear the people. Develop a hard core of men who love only God and fear only God. From them get your leaders. Take necessary precautions to keep the world from squeezing you into its own mold. Don't destroy that which you'll later need for a long-lasting operation. And verse 7 says, count on the presence of the Lord to fight for us and bring us victory. Oh, I'm sorry, it's verse 4. Any other principles now in this? Bill?
It seems to me the land they were possessed of, the promised land, they destroyed the enemy utterly. And in the others, they took them into captive or otherwise. Could this be our the Jerusalem around about us? In other words, we are to thoroughly evangelize it. And therefore, as we reach into further areas of the earth or relationships to that, we send out people, the missionaries, etc., so on and so forth, and we back them up with prayer. It's not their task to go in and set the captive free.
Could be. I hadn't seen that. Well, let's go to the next one, but let's take a break now for a few minutes, and then Harrison can change this thing around, and we'll come back in and go into 1 Thessalonians and see what we can get out of that before we break up for the day. To see a job description that we wrote up for an area representative, maybe next session, if you'd like to see that, while I can go through this with you briefly. A job description. Job description, by the way, is also a scriptural thing. Sometimes go through the book of Chronicles and just see how carefully outlined job descriptions for each man. All right, let's dwell in 1 Thessalonians now. 1, 2, and 3. And see what we can come up with by way of what Paul's objectives were as he went in. You recall in chapter 2, verse 1, it says, for yourselves, brethren, know that our entrance in unto you, that it was not in vain. Well, I checked this word vain. One translation says it was not futile. One translation says our visit was no failure. The word pictures of the Greek New Testament, Robertson's word pictures, brings out the word vain as being, this thought is, we actually achieved our objective. So Paul says, when we came to you, we actually achieved our objective. And then it seems to me that in these first three chapters, he tells them what his objective was among them, and then how he went about to achieve that objective. So since we're talking this morning about area ministry and the objective and achieving the objective and all that business, this might be an interesting passage to analyze. So what did you see in here now that looks like brings out one of Paul's objectives? Okay, Lauren?
Well, I think he had three objectives. Was faith, hope, and love. He wanted to build them up in faith and love and hope. And I think it goes through and kind of goes all fall under these three topics almost.
Verse 3, huh? Faith, develop their faith, love, and hope. Let me get that down. I'm reminded of 1 Timothy, where he says in verse 5, 1 Timothy 1:5, he says, "Now the end of the commandment..." Or I think Philip says the objective of our teaching, the objective of all of our instruction, or the end of all of our instruction, the thing that we're out to do, in our instruction, is charity or love out of a pure heart and a good conscience and faith unfeigned. And here he brings out the matter of instruction. It should be to help people in their life with others, love for their fellow man, love. And a good conscience, this would be the inner pure life, the 1 John 1:9 idea, living with themselves with a good conscience. That would mean no unconfessed sin, living a holy, godly life, the inside of a man. And then faith unfeigned would be this faith and trust in God. So the threefold aspect again of manward, inward, and Godward. Our instruction should fit in those categories. And I'm sure that these three things here do. Faith, hope, and love. Okay, anything? Anyone else see another objective that Paul had here is work with people? Okay?
Well, he had already accomplished it, but he was talking, and when he's saying what he did and what his objectives were, the thing that stood out most to me was just to getting the gospel to these people and getting them to accept it as truth and becoming Christians. The overall general objective.
1:5, huh?
Uh-huh.
Getting the gospel to them.
And then building their Christian life. And then helping them to grow.
1:8 also on that. It's not just in Thessalonians, but the evangelized area. Mm-hmm.
Yes, then from them, round about.
2:12 is the continuation of the objective. The second stage of the objective. That you are all worthy of God.
Yes. 2:12, I jotted down as one of his objectives. There's another one I had also. Okay, let's wait on that, see if you come up with it. You see another one?
And in chapter 1, verse 6, is, and you became followers of us, who was a leader to them, as well as preaching.
Right. Could lead them on in their walk with Christ. It seems to be, doesn't it?
5 we were the men. 6 he followed us, and then they were examples.
Right. He produced, reproduces here, and that was certainly one of his objectives. Okay.
In 3:12 and 13, he said, "And the Lord make you to increase and abound in love one to another." So. He wanted them to have brotherly love one toward the other, and even as we have, so he set an example for them. And to the end that he may establish your hearts unblameable in holiness before God, even our Father.
Yeah, I had that jotted down as an objective.
Mm-hmm. The last verse in 1, 2, and 3, all those chapters deal with that they should be looking forward to the Lord's coming again. All this is gearing toward that end.
Yes. You say we look at the expectation of the coming of Christ. Okay?
He sent a man to follow up after, well, he didn't just leave him on the road. He was still concerned for him.
Now that's in how to accomplish, wasn't it? I had one other objective down here.
3:8.
3:8. Yeah, 3:8. To stand fast in the Lord. That's an objective. Now, remember last night I pointed out that he trained them individually. Verse 11. As you know how we exhorted and comforted and charged every one of you as a father does his children, or each of you personally, or each of you one by one, the other translations say. Well, before we get into that, are there any other objectives that you saw? Now notice, interestingly enough, his objectives had to do primarily with what he wanted them to be, the kind of people he wanted them to be, walking worthy of God, who hath called you into his kingdom and glory, to love, abound one to another, establishing their hearts unblameable in holiness before God, standing fast in the Lord. Now, naturally, he wanted them to witness, as it says, and we saw in verse 1:8, 1:5, but it seems to me the overriding objective of his life was to produce a kind of person here, holy people, people with faith, a holy walk, and that sort of thing. Lauren?
I wrote down a long time ago in my Bible in verse 20, it says, you are the glory and joy. It's not the activity or anything, it's people.
Yeah.
And then this would go right along with Ephesians 1:12, that he should be to the praise of his glory.
Right. See, it's so easy to get sidetracked away from people. See, when we all get to heaven, there are going to be no steeples or no committees or no committee notes or no books or nothing else. It's going to be people up there. So, you know, we should give ourselves to the raw material of which heaven is made, right down here, and concentrate our lives on people and producing a kind of person that will walk worthy of God, to love one another, unblameable in holiness. And then this kind of people will certainly be a witness for Christ. All right, and by the way, now, that's easy to forget when you're out in the battle, because you think more of doing the job than you do the kind of people that can do that job. You get all involved out there in the work and forget the raw material of the work. Jim?
4:4 would seem to be an objective that's in the battle. Every one of you should know how to possess the vessel and sanctification another.
You read the whole book. You cheated. That's right. Very good. All right, let's go into methods. What was Paul's methodology to produce this thing that was on his heart? And that we saw that he did. Bill?
Every chapter he mentions he prays for him.
Okay. Give us the verses on that. 1:2, huh?
1:2, 1:3.
Yes.
2:13.
Yes, okay. Prayer is one basic method.
In verse 2:11, he said that he exhorted, or he told them what was wrong with them.
Mm-hmm.
He comforted them, and then he challenged them and charged every one of you as a father does his children. And there's three methods there.
Yes, now if you want to jot down a cross-reference, you can put down on verse 11, 1 Corinthians 14:3 and Deuteronomy 3:28. 1 Corinthians 14:3 and Deuteronomy 3:28. They all encompass the same general idea. Exhorting and comforting, or helping them meet their problems in a positive way, to counsel them with another, and then giving them a charge. a direction, a challenge in teaching and so on. I think that has that in mind. Exhort. Okay, and another one on methods. 2:8.
They gave themselves.
Yeah.
Souls to them.
Right. When I went to Seattle, and I'd been with Walter and Scott for 2 years, and I sort of tagged along with him, you know, held on to his apron strings. I kind of followed him around for 2 years, and then when I left, when I got to Seattle, there was a letter waiting for me, and this was the first time we'd ever been apart since we'd been Christians, because we both lived. He lived in Omaha, and I lived in Council Bluffs near there, and we were together during the summers. And went to conferences together, and we were in school together as classmates up in Minneapolis. When I got to Minneapolis, or got to Seattle away from him, that verse was waiting for me in a letter. He says, "So being affectionate and desirous of you, we were willing to impart to you not the gospel of God only, but also our own souls, because you were dear unto us." And I never read this book, but what I think of old Scotty on verse 8. Another one, you mentioned prayer as a method. You've heard of this man, J.O. Fraser, and Lawrence referring to him, the man that took over from Hudson Taylor, and how he noticed that the people in the outlying areas of his work, they moved ahead faster and were deeper in the things of the Lord than the people who were closer in that he got time with. And it bothered him. He couldn't figure out why. And then it suddenly dawned on him that he was spending three times as much time in prayer for those that he couldn't see as for those that he could see and get with. And these over here were really progressing and going great, and these over here were doing all right, but not nearly as well as these were. And so J.L. Fraser says there are four principles in building people. Four. Prayer, 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 and the Word. And the first three are prayer. So prayer is definitely a means of accomplishing the objective in the lives of people. Okay? Another one. Where do you do the preaching?
Part 5. Also, 2:2. I think we can cover it in Acts.
Go ahead.
I
had it broken down into two areas that he preached, or two sub-points under it that he preached the word. First of all, he preached it in spite of the results of Philippi. In spite of previous results.
Very good. What had happened to him in Philippi, by the way?
He sort of got kicked around.
Thrown in jail, Philippian jailer story and all that business, right?
And then he preached it as pleasing God, not men.
Now, I think that I'm convinced that preaching has a real part in the building of people. Otherwise, I wouldn't do so much preaching. But on weekend conferences, and one thing or another, if you want to, well, I don't want to go into the long philosophy on that, but to get people challenged and to impart broad knowledge on to a lot of people, you can just as well do it to 50 as you can one. But then it's in the discussions that all these things are solidified and made real and all. But I'm sold as a matter of preaching. You can get a lot done in it. And I think and one of the things that I try to do, by the way, is to help men learn to preach. I think it limits a man if he doesn't have the facility, as it were, to stand up with the scriptures and lay it out so people can understand it. Challenge.
Lord, don't you think that there's something more here, though, than just the formality of preaching, of getting in front of the people behind the pulpit? It's the fact that we can live the life and live an example and give them all kinds of encouragement, but there comes a time when you have to articulate the gospel.
Hmm.
You have to put it into words.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Also,
right. And preaching, in this sense, then, can be as gossiping across the back fence.
Putting it in the words they can hear.
Right. Very good.
And I think also, as was mentioned in 2:2, we should take a lesson from this, that even in hardships, that we should just take courage in the Lord and continue to preach.
And now, see, he says in Philippi, you know how we were treated in Philippi? He says we're shamefully treated. And he was. But I jotted down here that suffering sharpened rather than blunted the edge of his sword. All this suffering he went through, and by the way, analyze the life of the Apostle Paul sometime, and you'll notice that anything that happened to him, he could care less. Just write it off. But when someone tried to follow up his babes in Christ with some strange doctrine or some little thought that they would try to weave in that would follow up his babes, he made a federal case. He'd go to Jerusalem, he'd pound the table, he'd, you know, call councils together. But they could beat him, whip him, you know, throw him in prison, shipwreck, being bitten with vipers. You know, he didn't care about this stuff to him. But when something happened to his that affected his ministry and the lives of people, what a federal case he made. But his personal suffering didn't stop him.
In fact, doesn't it actually say, I'm not sure where, it says that suffering and trials and all this helps to build our character.
Right, that's the verse that I shared in James 1, 2 to 4, out of Phillips. Right.
And that's in verse 3, too, that he was careful who he sent to follow up his thing. Because he sent Timothy, who was the gospel of Christ, who was the minister of the gospel of Christ.
Yes. Yes, he was a fellow laborer. He calls another place a fellow soldier. That's an important point. You learn in 1 Corinthians 3 that it's not just doing follow-up that counts, but it's the kind of work you do, not the amount of work you do, but the quality or the kind. And he knew that he had to send a good man on this particular mission. So sending another and sending a good man is a method of accomplishing our objective. That assumes something, doesn't it? Assumes a man's been trained. Okay, over here. Yeah, obviously. He wrote to them, wrote letters to them. That's a method.
One of the reasons he had it in the good is because of their faith. He reminds them of in 27 to 10. Their faith is still in the whole world. So he couldn't send somebody that was not well qualified.
Right. Okay.
Also, we stress so much that the importance of meeting with people and of working with the people that you bring to the Lord. And I saw that in here, that he really wanted to get together with these people. It was a real desire to make sure that they were staying with it and that their faith wasn't faltering, and to check up on them, to give them courage and encouragement. And when he couldn't go himself, he wrote to them and actually sent for them. And he actually had his desire to meet with them.
Wherefore, when we could no longer stand it, you know, boy, it was in his heart. Okay, right?
Sort of inherent in here is the fact that he taught them by example. In Philippians 4:9, it says, those things which ye have both learned and received and heard and seen in me, do. And this was a principle of his life, that he taught them by letting them see what he was and how he did.
Yes, you know, a manner of men we were among you for your sakes. Live the life. Set the pace. Set an example. A true leader. Okay, let's take time for one or two more here, and then we better get over. Dorn? And motherly gentleness. Notice he likens himself to a mother and a father. In verse 7, he says, we're gentle among you, even as a nurse cherishes her children. I looked that word up, Doris. That's a mother who is nursing. Can you think of anything more gentle than a mother who is nursing, caring for this child? And then, as a father doth his children. And he really took this seriously, by the way, because he likened himself to a mother, then to a father. And verse, let's see if I can find this now. He says, you're taken from us. Where is that now? Taken from us. Not in heart, but here, verse 17. But we, brethren, being taken from you for a short time in presence. Not in heart, in presence, but not in heart. And the word taken there is orphaned. He likens himself to a mother, then to a father, and when he leaves, he says, now we're orphaned from you. This father-son bit really permeated his whole soul, you know. He looked upon these people as children and felt a tremendous concern for them and a responsibility to them. Not just a teacher-pupil relationship. That's important in the fulfilling of an objective that we're out to do. Okay, one more. Lauren?
Well,
I noticed he really went into the detail of what he didn't do. And I was just thinking, why? And well, he said, without deceit, without impure motives, without fraud or guile.
Yes.
And, but then I think the reason why is after a person's gone, it seems like these are all things that the enemy brings up. Well, he just got you by flattering words.
Hmm.
Or he just was after your money. Or he just wanted to please people that sent him. All these things. He went into eight different things. And I think it goes right along with verse 18, that Satan is against following.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. I noticed on that one there that he repudiates two things. He repudiates worldly ambition. He went out after money. But you know, it's, you can repudiate worldly ambition and not be out for their money and stand around in rags and have holes in the, in your souls, you know, and everybody will see them and still have to seek self-glory because of it. So he repudiates both things, worldly ambition and self-glory, nor of men sought to be glory. He wasn't out to either get money from them or things from them, or he wasn't out to for any self-glory in all this thing. He was giving himself to them. Another principle, of course. Giving himself. Okay, let's have a word of prayer, and next week we'll come back. And don't forget to turn in anything you'd like to see on how to for our next session that has to do with area ministry. And we'll try to cover it. Walt, would you dismiss us, please?